You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Our series of candidate forums continues later in the program, and we'll be talking with one of the candidates running for the first congressional district seat.
First, the ideal of an independent judiciary is as old as the country itself, but 39 states, including Wisconsin, elect justices to state courts, raising questions about how to balance judicial politicking and impartiality.
In the wake of the Supreme Court's Citizens United ruling of 2010, judicial races have seen an explosion of spending on ads by outside groups. According to the Brennan Center for Justice, these groups spent $24 million on judicial races during the last election cycle.
Journalist James Oliphant recently hit the campaign trail with a North Carolina Supreme Court justice. His recent article in the National Journal examines what happens when judges court constituents and cash. James, welcome to the show.
It's great to be here. Thank you for having me.
So you hit the campaign trail with, as we mentioned, a judge running for Supreme Court in North Carolina. Their election's going on now. Ours are in an off season, usually here in Wisconsin. You've covered, I think, political campaigns before. Did riding along with a judge feel any different than somebody running for Congress or something like that?
Well, it did and it didn't. It did in the sense that, you know, in a sense, campaign events are campaign events. But the scale is much smaller, even with a congressman or something like that. I basically rode along with a sitting justice of the North Carolina Supreme Court. And as I point out in the article, she actually had me drive her car to a judicial candidates forum in North Carolina. So it was basically just her and me, and she didn't have a staff around her, no handlers, no press people, nothing like that. And she's basically, her name's Sherry Beasley, and she's just basically been out there this summer stumping on her own for her Supreme Court seat.
And she had to ask for money like a candidate for any other office. Was there discomfort in having to do that?
Yeah, she was. She admitted to be it's not the most pleasant aspect of her job. Some of the other justices that I interviewed expressed an outright distaste for it. Justice Beasley did not, but some of the other justices called it the dreaded call time and felt very uncomfortable reaching out and asking donors for money. And an important point of all of this is exactly who they're asking to give that money, which donors are asking for that money?
Well, presumably, a lot of this if I'm a donor, the most likely person I'm going to be is somebody who's going to have an issue in front of a court.
That's correct. I mean, these are very small circles of donors. And we're talking about lawyers, large law firms, trade groups, businesses with an interest before the Supreme Court. And those are the people who are going to have any sort of information, any sort of awareness of the race. One of the biggest problems with Supreme Court elections is that these are low information races. Most voters have no idea who's running for a state Supreme Court. And that makes money disproportionately effective in races like these.
Well, stepping back from that particular race, a lot of states have elections for Supreme Court justices, state Supreme Court, other levels in the judiciary. Why? Why have so many states gone toward elections for their judges?
Well, you can talk about the good government aspect of it. I mean, it does ensure some level of political accountability for these judges and these justices. And it does go along with the idea that we should not treat candidates for the court any differently than we treat candidates for other political office. And that it's good for justices and judges to face the voters. In North Carolina, it's every 10 years or every 8 years. I understand in Wisconsin, it's every 10 years. But at the same time, other states have moved toward an appointment or some sort of merit retention system where candidates are screened by specialized boards or they're appointed by the governor or the state legislature, all with the idea of maybe pre-screening some of these candidates to make sure that they are actually fit for office.
And in, I think, most, maybe all cases, these are technically nonpartisan elections. You don't run as the Republican or Democratic candidate. I know that's the case in the one that you followed and here in Wisconsin. In practice, though, does it really play out that way?
No, that's a complete fiction. And just about everybody in North Carolina knew it. And it wasn't hard to discover somebody's political affiliation. They run in nonpartisan primaries, but it's very clear who the Democrat is and who the Republican is. And in this case, judges on both sides, they were endorsed by their respective state parties. So that basically takes any sort of pretense out of the equation.
And we mentioned in the intro there, Citizens United and money going into campaigns and into outside groups. How does that fit in with the election of judges?
Well, it's brought a whole new dimension to it in that it's given outside groups the capacity now to mount attack campaigns against certain justices. We saw that this spring in North Carolina, a justice who is considered leaning Democratic, she was up in a primary, and a group in North Carolina was formed a third-party group and spent almost $1 million trying to unseat her. It didn't work, but it's a sign of things to come, and it's a sign of what we're going to see across the country. There's a group in Washington called the Republican State Leadership Committee, which has started what it calls its Judicial Fairness Initiative. And what it's trying to do basically is ensure that there are conservative justices on state Supreme Courts to basically safeguard legislative accomplishments by conservative legislatures. And we've certainly seen that in Wisconsin with Governor Walker's labor reforms being upheld by your state Supreme Court this summer.
And our last Supreme Court election definitely got tied up in the recall campaign and everything and the court progress of Act 10, that particular law. You, in your piece, refer to Supreme Court races in Iowa and elsewhere in the country getting the national funding and national attention that you just mentioned. Can you talk through some of those cases?
Well, what we're seeing basically is the nationalization of these races, just like we're seeing in Senate races and House races across the country. And it goes to the idea of these outside groups. It all sort of started in 2010. You might recall the recall of the three Iowa Supreme Court justices who had voted in favor of same-sex marriage. That sort of got the ball rolling, and the idea that outside political money could begin to influence the outcome of these races. And I think we're going to only see this phenomenon grow and grow in coming years.
So you mentioned a Republican national group aimed at these state judicial elections. Is there any kind of response from national Democrats or their supporters?
We really haven't seen that. There was a group formed recently on the ground in North Carolina, but it's a North Carolina group. But I don't think it's a stretch to think that unions and other Democratic groups will eventually get involved. It's just the nature of the beast.
Now, one solution that some states have tried in an effort to get some of the money out of judicial races is public financing for judicial elections. We had that for a while in Wisconsin. It has since been repealed. I gather that's also the case in North Carolina. What are the pros and cons of public financing of elections for judges?
Well, it was passed in North Carolina at the beginning of last decade, and the idea was to sort of level the playing field for candidates and reduce the incentives to have to go out there and solicit money. And by many accounts, it worked. The justice that I profiled, Justice Beasley, she's an African-American woman who got her start as a public defender down in Fayetteville, North Carolina. And so her job, and she eventually became a trial judge down there. And so she didn't have the kind of background where she had a lot of extensive business contacts in the legal community or industry contacts, the kinds of relationships that lead to political influence, lead to political appointments. And the idea of the public financing system, rather, was to give candidates like this a fair shot at being elected to the Supreme Court. Now, Justice Beasley ran for the State Court of Appeals there using the public financing program back in 08. Now, as she's standing for re-election on the North Carolina Supreme Court, she has to raise money like everybody else. And she's at a great disadvantage vis-a-vis her opponent, who's backed by not only the state Republican Party, but the Chamber of Commerce and business groups throughout the state.
Well, the core concern of people who worry about candidates for judge having to go out and fundraise for an election is, are they going to be able to be impartial if their donors come before them in a court? You talked to candidates on different sides of elections there. What kind of things did you hear from the candidates as to how they'd address that?
Well, this has been an issue throughout the race. There are four seats up on the North Carolina Supreme Court, which is, I believe, historically unprecedented in that state. And the idea of influence has been following this election pretty much since the primary this spring. And to a man or to a woman, each of the candidates has said, well, I'm not for sale. You know, a campaign donation isn't going to buy my, you know, my support in an opinion, or it's not going to influence me in terms of a judicial decision. And of course, that's exactly what they're going to say. But that has not stopped some of the justices from adopting some ideological positions in representing themselves to the voters.
And one solution that's sometimes offered is the idea of, okay, recusal. If you've got a big donor in front of you, fine, you just sit this one out. Is that a common practice, though?
It is not. And as a matter of fact, the United States Supreme Court in 2009 examined this very question. And it basically, in a decision that was upheld or released by the conservative majority, they raised the bar. They established an extremely high standard for recusal in these situations. It's not enough, the court said, that you donated to the campaign of someone who ends up on the bench. You had to do something much more active, like, say, form a political action committee dedicated to unseating that justice's opponent, as was the case in that case.
We're talking about judicial elections and what happens when judges have to go out and raise money and shake hands on the campaign trail.
And we'd like to hear from you. Do you feel that the process of electing judges could compromise their impartiality? What do you think about the influence of outside interest groups? And how have you seen Citizens United play out in Wisconsin? Should there be stricter rules on how judges campaign and with what money? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking about the influence of money and politics in the judicial system, especially in states like Wisconsin that have elections for the Supreme Court and other judicial posts.
James Oliphant is with us. He's White House correspondent for the National Journal. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you like that we elect, say, our state Supreme Court justices here in Wisconsin? Is that a good idea? Or would you rather see some kind of merit selection? Do you think a campaign donations call into question the impartiality of judges, especially when their donors appear before them in court? And would you like to see the state's public financing law, it was called the Impartial Justice Law, returned here in Wisconsin? Call now at 800-642-1234, or you can tweet us at Central Time WPR. James, does there seem to be any kind of movement to change things to get money out of judicial races in the country, or are people just kind of accepting the status quo?
Well, I'm afraid the trends are going the other way. And one of the problems is that this has all been bound up with the trend that we're seeing on the national level, which is deregulation of campaign finance. So it's become sort of an article of faith among Republicans to repeal public financing laws and to basically open up these elections to outside influences and big money. And, you know, I should add that when you do that, it basically rewards big donors, industry groups, and helps cement the outcome of some of these races. So there's very little incentive, at least on the Republican side, for any sort of legislative reforms. And so we're basically in a situation now where The judicial arena is just a few years behind the political arena, but I think we're going to see it catch up very quickly.
Now, outside of the money, you touched on this a little earlier. The laws have changed and the customs have changed as far as what judges can say when they're out campaigning, what ideological stances they can take, what they say about particular issues. How has that evolved?
Well, it's interesting. There was a case before the U.S. Supreme Court about 10 years ago, which basically examined whether judicial candidates have the same free speech rights as other political candidates. And the Supreme Court ruled that, yes, they do. And what we've seen now is it takes the form in some pretty mild situations. I was at a candidate's forum in Charlotte, North Carolina, where a justice who obviously identified as a Republican said he disagreed with the Supreme Court's finding in the Affordable Care Act case that the law was constitutional. So that clearly sort of marked the boundaries of his ideology, where another justice said she disagreed with the Citizens United decision, and so that clearly marked her ideological view. And we're going to see more and more of this, I think. No judge or judicial candidate is going to come out and say, I'm going to vote X in a pending case. I think that's still off limits. But in terms of signaling to voters what their judicial philosophy is, that's A-OK now, and I think we're going to see a lot more of it.
we've talked a lot about how the campaign could affect the impartiality of a judge who gets elected in their term. But also, does knowing that you'll need to campaign again make you kind of look over your shoulder and wonder what decision, what opinion could be an attack at in the future?
I think you've hit on a very concerning topic for justices. When I talked to Justice Beasley, we talked about whether a dissent would be used against her by her opponent that she wrote in a business case. And it turned out that the very forum we were driving to, her opponent brought it up right away, signaling to the crowd that he believed that she was anti-business and he was pro-business. And it may provide a political disincentive for justices on state Supreme Courts to take unpopular opinions, to side with defendant rights, or to to do anything that could be manipulated into saying that they're soft on crime. As we all know, that's a favorite theme for campaign ads. There are worries about a chilling effect on judicial independence.
You mentioned Supreme Court races or court races in general being low information races where voters don't have a lot to work with. Are attack ads like the ones you just mentioned, picking out one opinion among many, particularly effective in that environment?
Well, it's interesting because there was a widespread belief in North Carolina that the attack ad that was aired against the justice in the primary, Justice Hudson, backfired because all the attention it received in the press ended up boosting her name recognition to the point where she now credits the attack ad for surviving the primary. And if she goes on and survives the general election, it may be just for that very reason. And so that is one significant difference between judicial elections and, say, Senate and House races, where name recognition is less of an issue. An attack ad can end up serving the victim better than the attacker.
You know, when I think of politicians out on the campaign trail, I definitely think of a specific type of personality, the natural politician, outgoing, extroverted. Is that necessarily the common judicial personality?
No. And we talk a lot about what judicial temperament is. And you have to remember that these people are lawyers. They went to law school. They, in most cases, they were clerks. They're people who love the law. They love to read the law. They love to argue about the law. And they got into the field because they're scholars. They're people who care about nuance. And politics is about anything but nuance, right? It's about the big statement. It's about the promise. It's about ideology. And so it's put a lot of these candidates in very uncomfortable positions because they're not naturally gregarious people. They're people who, and as some of the candidates confessed to me, they were looking forward to actually going back and being able to work on a decision and read the briefs and be cloistered away again from the political arena.
I want to bring a caller in here now. We've got Emily on the line in Racine. Emily, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Emily?
Well, I was just calling because it just seems a little frustrating to me that, with lobbying, it seems like our government is bought off by big business. And if we allow our elections for judicial elections to be influenced by big money and big business, don't you think that our judges will make their decisions based on favor as opposed to the facts in the case?
Emily, thanks for the call. James, your thoughts on that question?
Well, it's certainly a concern of advocates and good government groups that will be the case. And it may not be that there's a direct link established, say, between a donor and an outcome. But the idea that a candidate backed by the state chamber of commerce will have a certain philosophy that will be reliable, that will end up protecting the business interests of the state, or that you can sort of predict how somebody will go in a given case, is a concern. And it's why in the federal level, we don't elect our judges. We appoint them. And now that has its own problems, obviously. But it's to help project that sense of integrity, the sense that the judges are above the fray.
And beyond the integrity and the impartiality, I mean, I think of the founding fathers, and maybe I have my civics lessons wrong, as wanting the judicial system, the judiciary as a whole, to be a little more insulated from the day-to-day politics of the time. Is that just a sort of ideal that never happened, or is that some reality that we've moved away from?
No, I think it is a reality that we've moved away from, that and it's sort of just, you know, the progression of modern life, that everything has become so polarized and politicized, and that our judiciary, our state judiciaries are becoming like that. And it's also, it speaks to, though, the modern environment, which money can play such a fundamental role in shaping the outcome of these races. And what we're seeing is that the groups are catching on, and that a legislative agenda accomplished can be a short-term gain without a judiciary backing it up. And the trends are on both sides for these issues to be litigated. Think about, again, the Affordable Care Act on the federal level. So what you want to try to do is guarantee an outcome. That's what this is all about, on the legislative level, on the executive level, and on the judicial level.
Yeah, we've seen that at the state level, where a lot of things that go through the legislature and are signed by a governor don't really happen until they make their way up through the courts. Is that a national trend as well in other states? And is that something that's going to keep raising the stakes and the financial stakes for these judicial elections?
Yeah, the courts have become a great weapon in sort of the struggle between the conservatives and the liberals. And as we've seen with voter ID, as we saw with Governor Walker's labor reforms, as we've seen with the Affordable Care Act, we've seen it with Dodd-Frank. Anything that is sort of a strong policy component is going to be litigated for its constitutionality and its legitimacy. And so courts, you could argue, have never played a greater role in the legislative process than they're playing right now.
We'll leave it there. James, thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
That was James Oliphant. He's White House correspondent for the National Journal.